But in the Mont Belli Arts, they found two new ones, and each of them were at quite high percent. One of them was at 9% and one of them was at 7%. So now we know actually there's quite a portfolio of these things that can be as common as 10% that each individually cause embryo lethality. They found 9 mutations in the causal haplotypes that they believe are the cause of the disease themselves, because they have a whole lot of sequence data. So you could also get a new mutation in a common haplotype. If a mutation occurs, it's most likely to occur in a common haplotype. So haplotypes could look the same for two bulls, but one might carry a mutation and one might not. And in that particular case, you wouldn't see a complete absence of offspring that have a homozygous for that haplotype. You just see an underrepresentation of it. And in Belgium, they've done some analyses where instead of looking for complete absence of the region, they've looked for underrepresentation of the region. And when they do that, they find many more regions that have been found the other way. They don't know if all of them really are embryo lethals, or some of them are just ones that were underrepresented by chance because they haven't observed enough offspring. So application to beef cattle. The problem is, in beef cattle, that the data that we have at the moment for 50K genotypes is mostly from sires that have been widely used. So a sire that has been widely used is probably one that you believe to be superior. So if the sire is one that is superior for some particular condition, it could well be that it doesn't carry some of those defective regions. So ideally what we need to find these defective regions is crops of animals before they've been selected. And that's what they had in the dairy industry. They had young calves that are done. You also need quite a big data set if you're going to test for all but the most one or two common ones. And I don't know if Jerry Taylor's in the audience. I'm not sure if he has looked at this in his lab, but we are intending to look at this. But the more data we have, the easier it is to look. So we haven't looked yet, but between now and the end of the year, we will be definitely looking at this across all the breeds that we have 50K genotypes on to find if any of the haplotypes are not represented. So there is another approach. So there's a third approach. The first approach is when you find a mutant-looking animal. The second approach is when we find a haplotype we don't see. The third approach is to look at the sequence, and it's one of the reasons that everybody is interested in sequencing some animals. So can we identify a loss-of-function mutation from a gene sequence? And a loss-of-function mutation is where the gene product has little or no function. So just to remind you, the structure of DNA, it's a whole lot of base pairs, a whole lot of chemicals, A's and T's and C's and G's. And one of the remarkable things about that particular structure is that an A bonds with a T, a C with a G. So if you rip it in half and reform it, you can make 2 exact copies, at least in theory, like I've shown at the bottom. But it turns out that when that happens, errors occur all the time. And somebody on good authority has told me that actually errors happen as often as 1 in every 100 base pairs. Now, the average chromosome is 100 million base pairs, so that says 1 million errors get made when a chromosome is being duplicated. Now, that would be absolutely disastrous. So there are all kinds of genes that come along and repair those errors. And almost every one of them gets repaired while the replication is occurring. But there are some errors that slip by, just a few, not very many, a few. One of them is where the base pairs get swapped for something else, and that's what we call a single nucleotide polymorphism. And many of these errors will never get transmitted, because these errors will only get transmitted if they occur in testicular or ovarian tissue, right? So anything that happens anywhere else, well, it has to be a germline. And the other kind of replication errors, we can have a piece missing. It could be a small piece or a big piece. We could have a piece duplicated. It could be a small piece or a big piece. It could be inverted. It could be translocated, where it comes off one chromosome and goes on another. So many different kinds of defects. Do these errors matter? Well, it all depends on where it happens, in relation to the structure of the genome. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about gene structure. So these chromosomes, 30 pairs of them in cattle. Each individual chromosome on average has about 100 million bases in it, but not all of that DNA codes for genes. Only a small piece of it does. So every now and then, if you look at it, you find a gene, and then there are other pieces in between that are not genes. There's a lot of jargon in this area. An intergenic region is the region between genes. So actually, most of the genome is intergenic regions. So if you go and mess with an intergenic region, we can't really predict what would happen. It may end up being important, it may not, but we don't really understand why. So a mutation in an intergenic region, we can't predict if that's going to cause a problem. But if we look inside a gene, it's not quite like it was described to me in biology. A gene, if you look inside it, actually has pieces that are expressed called exons, and it has pieces in between that interrupt the expression called introns. And in fact, even within the gene, a lot of it is introns. And at the beginning of the gene, there's a signal that says start, this is the start of the gene, and at the end of the gene, there's a signal that says stop, this is the end of the gene. So if we mess something up, if it's in an exon, we can predict what that might do. If it's in an intron or an intergenic region, we don't know what it will do. So of all of the massive numbers of mutations that might take place, we can only predict a few of them. And if we look at it inside any one of those exons, what we find is a triplet code. Now, many of the mutations that we see that cause diseases are where there's a deletion and a whole exon is missing, it's gone. But the other kind of mutation that can occur is when the sequence of those A's and T's and G's and C's within the exon changes. And those sequences of A's and T's and G's and C's, each of them represents an amino acid based on a triplet code. So they're read in series of three. So I just show you the ACC corresponds to threonine. GCC corresponds to alanine. Those are amino acids. And so the exon sequence dictates the amino acid sequence, which dictates the gene product. And this just shows you, for one of the diseases that I showed you in the beginning, this just shows you what the protein looks like for the normal animal or for the mutant animal, and the only difference was a change in the triplet code that changed one amino acid in a very large protein. And if you know the sequence of amino acids, there's software that can show you what the protein looked like. So it's not just like a flat piece of string. It actually forms into a shape. So this is on the left, that red and blue thing is showing you the shape of the normal gene product or the mutant gene product. And they look almost identical grossly, but if you blow up the little region I've shown in the black circle, the one on the bottom, the blue one, which is the normal one, has a yellow disulfide bond between the two amino acids, whereas the red one, with one amino acid not there, the disulfide bond doesn't form. And that means that this hormone doesn't work. So it's a bit like a baseball mitt. You know, a baseball mitt is designed to catch a ball, but if you didn't have the piece strung on between your thumb and your finger that's meant to hold the ball, you wouldn't be able to catch a ball. So a subtle change to the amino acid can stop it working. And this happened to be the cause of one of those diseases, just a change in one amino acid. So whether it is important or not, when you change one of those triplets, depends on which one you change. And since triplets, you have four choices for the first, four choices for the second, four choices for the third. There's 64 different combinations of triplets, but they're not 64 amino acids. There's only 20 of them. So that means that more than one triplet can code for the same amino acid. So what I show you here on the columns, to start with the left, is the first base of the triplet, U, C, A, or G. And this is on RNA, so it's a U rather than a T. Along the columns, we've got the second base, and within each of the blocks, we've got the third base. So what you'll notice is if you look at the very, very top left, UUU is phenylalanine. If the first one changes and we drop down four, it becomes CUU, it gets leucine. So that's a change in the amino acid. So that will change the protein. And depending on where it changes, it may or may not have an effect. You know, if your baseball glove, if you change something on the back of it, behind your wrist, it's really not going to matter. So many of these won't matter, many of them will. It depends where they occur. But if we change that first amino acid, if we change that first base pair, we usually change the amino acid. So that means we have a non-synonymous, so we have a different protein. If we change the second one, we go from one of those columns to another, then we also change the amino acid. But if we change the third one, there are many cases where you see, because there are only 20 amino acids, we don't change it. So when you go and mess with that triplet, many of the times you can change it and you won't make any difference to the protein, so you won't cause a problem. There is another special pair in there that I've shown in the circle, and that's a stop. So there's a special triplet that says this is the end of the protein. And one of the worst things that can happen is if you put a stop in earlier, then the protein doesn't form properly. So you imagine you take the gene that makes estrogen and you break it in the middle with a stop, then you only get half of the protein formed. That's not going to work properly, so we know that's going to have a defect. Okay, so genomic variation. So how many variants are there in these things? Well, we sequence animals, and I'll show you here four columns. The first one is some sequencing we did in the Iowa State herd. We sequenced six animals, we sequenced one bull, we sequenced some of the sons and other relatives. The second column I show you is from six crossbred bulls that were sequenced. The third column is a summary from 500 bovine animals that were sequenced. And the fourth column shows you the data from 1,000 humans that were sequenced. And it's always a little bit hard to compare these things because there's many different ways to sequence the data. There's different depths that can be sequenced. There's different software to understand the sequence. But just comparing the kind of results, what we saw in our Iowa State animals was between 2 and 4 million times per bull, we saw one base pair being changed. Now, since some of those bulls were sons of others, they would have shared a lot of the ones that their father had. The six crossbred bulls we sequenced, there were between 8 and 12 million of these single-tip nucleotide polymorphisms across the six bulls. And they were not closely related bulls, so they probably had different ones. Amongst 500 bovine sequence, there were 29 million of these. Remember, there's 30 chromosomes, so that says there's probably about a million of these SNPs per chromosome across a number of sires. So that's about one every 100 base pairs. So a huge amount of diversity. In humans, these 1,000 humans, they did 25 million of them. So about the same number they're seeing in the humans as they're seeing in the cattle. Now, one of the statistics I don't have for the non-human ones is that 40% of the ones they found in the 1,000 humans were unique to one of those individuals. These were unrelated people. My guess is it's going to be much lower than that in cattle because we have widely used sires. But still, any animal you choose will have some of its genome which came from its mother, which she got from her mother, which she got from her mother, and those ones could be very, very rare. But the other ones that came from the sires will be common. Anytime you use a sire, any of those mutations that were rare to him instantly become common in the population if he's widely used. There are also lots of those insertions and deletions. So one of the bulls that we did, a bull that was done at 12x coverage, we had 150,000 deletions. About 70% of them were in the region between the genes, so we have no idea what they do. In the human data, about 60% of them were between the genes. And then within the genes, remember, there were the introns, the interrupting bits. We saw about 30% of them in those intronic bits. In the humans, they saw 36%. So again, we don't know what those do. The exotic ones we saw, in the humans, it was about 1%. In the six crossbred bulls, they were done deeply, 30x each. There was about 50,000 that actually changed the triplet, that actually modified the triplets, right? 22,000 of those were synonymous, so they don't change the amino acid sequence. A whole bunch of them, about 27,000 of them among those six bulls, changed the amino acid sequence. In this one bull we did in our herd that we've used quite a bit, there were 13,000 of those that changed the amino acid sequence. But the ones I told you that are of particular concern are the stop gains. So that means where a stop has been gained prematurely. And there were 159 of those in that bull, 9111. Now, you might say, well, a crossbred bull, does this problem go away? No, those crossbred animals we had, they were done more deeply. There were more than 300 of those. Okay. Now, in the human genetic mutation database, they record 70,000 mutations that have a known gene location and change that they think will cause a disease. And amongst the 1,000 humans that I just reported there, over 1,000 of those mutations recorded in the database existed amongst those people. And a few of them existed as homozygotes, which means the fact that somebody has published them and said, in homozygous form, this gene is a problem, they've actually got it wrong. They didn't find the right causal mutation. So it's going to take a little bit of time to sort all of this out exactly. But any particular individual out of those humans, they carried anything from 10 to 40 of those broken genes. And on average, an average person in their study carried 20 of them. And in addition, on average, they carried 450 damaging mutations. So every individual, every one of us, every cow, every dog, every horse is going to have a lot of these damaging mutations. So just looking at those stop gain ones where the amino acid was broken in this bull 9111, here's a list of a few of them that James Colty's looked up to see if they might cause problems. And there's a whole lot of jargon. Each of these genes have a name, but you can see each of the ones he's listed there have been shown to be lethal in mice or lethal in humans or associated with some kind of problem. So any one of those, if you were to mate that bull to his daughters, you could end up with offspring that are homozygous for them. And they could end up being a lethal condition. So when that bull's used widely, as long as he's mated to cows that don't carry that mutation, that's no problem. You're never going to see it. But later on in future generations, if you widely use some of the sons that are causing that mutation, then you could see a problem. But you're not going to see it anyway, because even if 10% of the animals carry the problem I showed you before, it's probably not going to have a high enough level of problem for you to actually notice it. But it is going to be there, and it is going to be affecting your productivity. There are also some others that were potentially damaging. So there was one that causes abnormal sperm motility. There were a bunch that affected heart function, epilepsy, diabetes, autism, estrogen response. So there's the BRCA gene. So that was the gene that Angelina Jolie had a defect in and caused her to improve her chances of not getting cancer by removing her breast. We have a mutation in that in 9111. And that, we know, affects things like estrogen metabolism. So it could well affect reproduction in these animals. So there's lots of it out there. Every animal out there has got it. So the idea back in the 70s of melanocytosis, that you're going to find a defect and you're going to cleanse the population, is just dreaming. It's the tip of the iceberg. Everybody's got these things. Every bull, every cow. So what you have to do is manage them. You're not going to be able to get rid of them. So what does a commercial producer do? Well, one of the ways to avoid the problem is to crossbreed, because different breeds are likely to have different mutations. So it could well be that much of the advantage you get from crossbreeding is actually from minimising the number of times we have two copies of one of these broken genes. So that would be a safe way to minimise it. The next safest thing you could do is outbreed, which means if you use a sire you like, you don't go back and use his sons and their sons and continue on like that. That's exactly the kind of thing that's going to accumulate the frequency of the ones that are problem. And if you don't like the idea of outbreeding, you don't like the idea of crossbreeding, then you put up with it. And you can do that as well. And ideally, if you're going to do that, then please provide us with hair samples or DNA when you do see something suspicious, and then we can find it and have a test for it, and then you will be able to do something about it in the future. If you're a seed stock producer, we have to get you to change the shoot, shovel and shut up mentality, right? You have to stop doing that. You have to report this to us so we can find it and have a test for it, right? Everybody has got these things. We're going to find them eventually by other means anyway, by things like gene sequencing. or by what's found in humans and other species. And ultimately, we'll be able to go back and see which animals have it. And if you do have them, provide us with DNA samples. If you see suspicious things, pull some deer. Get some hair cards from GeneSeq or somewhere else. Pull some hair and put it in your filing cabinet. If you see it again and accumulate some samples, then we can do something about it. Use SNP genotyping because they'll allow us to resolve haplotypes. And as soon as we find these things, we can come back and tell you whether animals might be at risk. Use DNA tests for known defects. You could carry a parent, but that's not recommended, particularly for outstanding animals. If you have an outstanding animal that carries a defect, you know that half of the sperm from that bull are going to be clean of it. So why on earth would you cull that bull? What you would sensibly do is you would use those bull and you would test the offspring, and you would use the offspring that were clean of the defect, right? You can't purge the offspring. You can't purge everybody and get rid of everybody carrying the defect. You manage the animals that are carrying them by testing among their offspring and choosing those offspring to use in the next generation that don't carry the defect. Breed associations, we need you to collect as much phenotypic data as possible, particularly for reproduction, particularly from total herd reporting. So if not all your herds do total herd report, if you don't require, if some of them do, that data is valuable because it allows us to go back and look and identify some of these things much faster. You need to encourage the wider use of genomic panels because the sequencing, the haplotype, all of these technologies make use of those 50K, or we don't actually use 50K anymore, we now use like 70K or 20K. All of those panels allow us to find these things faster. We need to explore opportunities to deliver decision support tools. So decision support tools where the database knows the defects a particular bull carries, knows the defect the father of your cow carried, and can work out which matings you should do that minimise the chance of these problems. And you're going to have to expect to record a lot more single gene information. So the idea that the only thing you're going to be recording out of, say, these high-density panels is a molecular breeding value, I don't think that's right. You're going to have to record many, many more mutants than just the little list that I showed you from Max Spangler's website. If you're an AI company, then you should be using SNP high-density panels on all your AI sires. I think you'll probably be individually sequencing all future bulls. Some companies have started doing it already. And one of the questions about it is from a liability point of view. So like that company in New Zealand with the dominant defect, whose responsibility is it if you sell semen or sell a bull and it turns out to be defective? And if you had sequenced that bull, if you could have found the defect before you had sold it, whose fault is it? So maybe it's a time where an AI company should be sequencing a bull and making the sequence available. So then at least they can say, well, we used all the science available to tell you what we knew about the bull. So if there's a defect, you know, that's like reading the fine print. The fine print was the DNA sequence that was available on that bull. There are still questions from a legal perspective, and I'm not a lawyer, but you're meant to sell things that are fit for purpose, but then there's other things that say let the buyer beware. So I guess there'll be test cases in the future that determine whose liability it is when you sell an animal that turns out to have a mutation that might be a de novo mutation. And that's why AI bulls need to be individually sequenced. It might be a bull like the one I showed you from Matrix, the defect that he had that neither his father nor his mother had. You can't just rely on the pedigree to find these things. Industry and the science community, we need to sequence the widely used historical bulls. We need to annotate the variants, so that means going through all of those thousands of mutations and identifying the ones that might be a problem, and then looking and seeing which bulls carry those and looking and seeing how frequent they were. Populating the SNP chips with interesting variants. So the shelf life on these chips is not very long, so they're remanufactured quite regularly, so we have already started putting custom content on these GeneSeq chips so that we can validate some of these extra things. So what you're going to see happening in the future is these panels evolving rapidly where new information is put on them, anything that we are suspicious might be a problem, and then the moments an animal's a genotype, we'll be able to learn more about them. We need to communicate test results of validated effects. We need to further develop implement decision support tools to manage selection and mating. So in summary, Finding unfavourable mutations, we can do phenotype first, which relies on you guys. We can do haplotype first, which requires having SNP genotypes. And we can do sequence first, which relies on bioinformatics and leverages what is known about humans and mice. All three methods will produce information that will increase our ability to predict performance and identify above average individuals. So what you see as an average animal out there now is an average animal carrying a lot of defects that might be impacting their performance. So that's why I see it as good news that we know everybody's carrying things, because good news is going to allow us to predict more accurately the performance of those animals in the future. Selection and culling should be aimed at increasing the frequency of favourable alleles and reducing the frequency of unfavourable alleles, avoiding matings that can produce homozygous recessives, but not eliminating the unfavourable alleles instantly. We want to gradually reduce their frequency. There's no problem with a mutant allele that's out there while it's very, very rare in the population and doesn't cause any problems. What we have to prevent is it being used again in the future so that we have it come together in a homozygous form. I just want to acknowledge a bunch of the other people that are working with us on some of these topics. I'm sorry if I've cut the question time a bit short. Thanks.